Welcome to another episode of the Exhale Podcast, a candid conversation about current matters relating to respiratory diagnostic and lung health. Today's hosts are Mark Russell, Marketing Communications Manager, and Troy Pridgen, Executive Vice President of Sales and Operations for Vitalograph in North America, a global leader in respiratory diagnostics. Today, we had an interesting conversation with Paul Oblonsky and Rick Bressler. Paul is the president of the ARDS Alliance, and Rick is a patient who had COVID double lung pneumonia, COVID-induced ARDS, and he ultimately needed a double lung transplant to survive. Acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS, is an acute, diffuse, inflammatory form of lung injury and a life-threatening condition in seriously ill patients. It's characterized by poor oxygenation, pulmonary infiltrates, and acute onset.
Well, Paula and Rick, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Please give us a little background on yourselves, education, experience, and current responsibilities.
Sure. So I am Paula Blonsky. I'm the president and co-founder of the ARDS Alliance. And my background with ARDS is almost 25 years ago now, next month, my sister had some minor surgery and ended up with an infection in her wound. So she ended up going back to the hospital and ultimately ended up with a bad infection in her wound, which turned into sepsis. So sepsis is an infection that's in your blood. Obviously, that's very bad because you have blood throughout your body. So her sepsis actually turned into ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome. And we'll talk a little bit about what that means later in the podcast. So she fought with ARDS, and she also had leukemia at the time for about 8 weeks. And ultimately, she unfortunately passed away from ARDS in August of 1998. It's almost 25 years. Next month, it'll be 25 years. So since that time, I've been involved in the ARDS community, supporting patients and families and physicians in any way I could. So that's my story with ARDS. So I'll pass it over to Rick to tell his story.
Hi, thanks, Paula. My name is Rick Bressler, and I am a survivor of ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, which will also be explained at a later point. ARDS has several different causes. Mine happened to be COVID-induced. 2 years ago, just a little over 2 years ago, I tested positive for COVID just 4 days before I was to get started with my doses of the vaccine, and I was hospitalized within a week of that time. My health deteriorated rather quickly and ultimately progressed to acute respiratory distress syndrome. So I have, unfortunately, firsthand experience as a survivor of it. So I understand what it feels like to not be able to breathe. It's basically feels like you're slowly suffocating. Others, like myself, would also say that it's very much and very similar to drowning as to what we had imagined it would be. So it's a very painful experience, not just physically, but emotionally and mentally. And it's also not just something that the individual goes through, it's something their entire family, their loved ones, everyone experiences. And it was through, after surviving that, that I got connected to an online support group that operated through Zoom that Paula started. That's how Paula and I met, and we became friends. And when the ARDS Alliance was started up, I was asked to be one of the board members, which I happily accepted. And since that point, I've been focusing primarily on fundraising for the organization, but I also do essentially whatever Paula asks of me, or I try to help her in any way that I can to get our goals accomplished.
I can tell you both have a deep personal connection to this. Obviously, you having experienced it, you know, firsthand, and Paula, the situation with your family, it sounds, to be honest, terrifying. I can only imagine what it must be like to go through. But perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the ARDS Alliance and what is the mission that you bring?
Sure, absolutely. So the ARDS Alliance was formed during COVID, to be honest with you. I think we have similar stories. So during COVID, which hit our population horribly and really affected them in so many ways, I was at home like everybody else was at home, not able to leave, not able to do anything. But I had been in contact with some ARDS patients, and I knew they were struggling. I knew I was struggling. So I decided to start an online support group. I thought that was a way maybe we could all come together and support each other, both mentally, a way for survivors to talk to each other, to not feel so alone. So I decided one night, I said on a Tuesday night, I'm going to go on Facebook and say, hey, I'm going to start these support groups and see what happened. I didn't know if I was going to be sitting there by myself or if people were going to actually join. And the latter was the case. So they were very popular. They were very successful. Quite quickly, I found out that one support call was not going to be enough. People from England started joining, people from the Netherlands. We truly went worldwide quite quickly. And a Tuesday night at 7 p.m. wasn't going to work for those in Europe. So we started a second call on Saturday mornings. And again, very well attended. And quickly we started talking and they told me their family members were also struggling in what I consider doing one for family members. So we started two more of those, one at night, one in the morning, so that we could catch everyone's. So the little idea bloomed into four support calls a week, and they were very well attended. Through those discussions with the support call, we quickly realized that the community was in need of many things that just a support call wouldn't help with. So I talked to two other women and we decided to form the Arts Alliance. So it was kind of formed through COVID, knowing that the need was so great for the arts community. So we're dedicated to promoting and furthering charitable, educational, and scientific opportunity for the awareness, research, and to improve the quality of life for all those affected by ARDS. So really what that means is we're an agency for information and advocacy for the patients and the families, right? We want to be there for whatever they need. Do they need information? Do they need to find a doctor that specializes in ARDS? Do they need to be transferred? Medical professionals come for us. Pharmaceutical companies, do you need a patient for your study? Whatever the community needs. And we wanted to make sure that we were there for all those affected by ARDS, not just patients, not just families, not just doctors, but everybody. That's very important to our mission. Awareness is a struggle with ARDS. ARDS has been around a very long time, yet every single family that reaches out to me says, "What is this? I've never heard of it." Awareness is a big goal for the ARDS Alliance. So that's kind of a general overview of our mission and what we hope to accomplish.
Okay, so what is ARDS? And describe the effects of ARDS condition diagnosed for a patient.
So ARDS stands for Acute Respiratory Distress Syndrome. Explaining it in layman's terms, ARDS is essentially a life-threatening lung injury that allows fluid to leak into the lungs. And so basically what happens is, as a result of that, your blood's not able to get enough oxygen circulated through the body. So obviously organs within the body won't get the oxygen they need to function properly, and therefore you don't function properly. You're struggling to breathe. As I previously mentioned, it's sort of like I related to the feeling of suffocating or drowning. And sadly, I remember that experience. I remember it all too well. It's extremely painful and so forth. It basically, in a little bit more deeper explanation, it's the alveoli within the lungs that fill with the fluid from whatever caused the injury. So as mentioned before, in my particular case, mine was COVID-induced because it's a respiratory infection. And so what happened was the COVID virus in my case, attached to like the cells within the upper airways, and it sets off this massive immune system response, causes inflammation. You end up getting the typical symptoms like a sore throat, nasal congestion, cough. That's what I actually first felt before realizing and finding out that I had COVID. But there's other ways that that can happen. The number one cause is sepsis, as Paula mentioned and discussed. There are various other ways that it can be caused. I forget what the exact number is, but I know there's at least 80 different causes, if I'm correct on that, Paula.
Correct.
Yeah. So that's kind of what makes it difficult, because it has so many different potential causes. And you have this one thing that comes out of so many different life-threatening issues, and it becomes even more life-threatening. It becomes more severe. So that's, in a nutshell, essentially what acute respiratory distress syndrome is.
Yeah, as you say, it can be brought about in many different ways. I guess I'm curious, once a person's been diagnosed with it, how do they go about monitoring and, of course, looking to see if there's any improvement in that condition specifically?
So ARDS is not something you live with, right? It's similar to pneumonia. You are very critical. You're in the hospital. And quite bluntly, you either make it through or you don't, right? It's not something you live with. It's a syndrome, right? So you leave the hospital, you no longer have ARDS. So some of the treatments is what we'll talk about for ARDS. ARDS can either, I hate to use the word mild because there is no mild ARDS, but there is some forms that are less severe than others. So I'll say that. So the treatment depends on how severe your case of ARDS is. the number one goal for any treatment for ARDS is to give the lungs time to heal. They need to repair themselves because they are critical. So depending on the severity, it's really support for that breath that you're unable to get. So more non-invasive methods could be like high flow oxygen. So when you're in the ICU, they could give you BiPAP. It's through a nasal cannula, high flow oxygen. That's kind of the least invasive. Most times everybody's awake when they're on BiPAP, and some people do recover quite quickly just using that. When that's not enough, the patient is usually put on a ventilator to assist with that breathing. And a lot of times they're put into a drug-induced coma because it's very hard to have all these tubes. It's very hard to be on a vent. You're going to fight back. So in order to give the body time to heal, traditionally, they do put somebody into a drug-induced coma. There is a lot of research now showing that there's a good amount of research showing you should keep people awake while in the vent. It could reduce ICU delirium and many other things. So there's a lot of different therapies and a lot of different practices when somebody's vent to be awake or not to be awake. Sometimes if you're on the ventilator, you will get a tracheotomy. I've talked to countless families and survivors over the years. It's very hard for the family to make the decision to trach their loved one. They think it's going to be invasive. It's going to hurt. It's going to leave a scar. But ultimately, every survivor I've talked to says it's much more comfortable. It'll reduce the vocal cord damage. So it's really a good thing. Some other therapies is prone positioning. So to turn the person kind of face down. It kind of lets the fluid drain off the lungs. There's wonderful beds now that'll do it automatically because it's very hard to prone somebody when they have a vent and when they have tubes and chest tubes and IVs. So it's wonderful therapies coming out that'll do that for you. Moving down, if none of this has worked, there is something called ECMO that they're putting people on now. That's extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. Say that five times, right? ECMO. So that's similar to like a heart and lung bypass machine that they use in open heart surgery. So what it does is it takes the blood out of the body, puts the oxygen in it, and puts it back. So it allows the lungs time to heal because they're not having to work so hard. And then kind of the last case scenario, if none of this has worked and the lungs are damaged beyond repair, they look to transplant. So transplant, and Rick, I know, can talk to transplant. Post-COVID, our ARDS community, I think I knew one person that had a lung transplant in the last 20 years. Post-COVID, I know three or four. So again, COVID has really wreaked havoc on the lungs of ARDS patients. So again, that's kind of the current treatments and therapies for ARDS while you're in the hospital.
So that's very interesting. And when a person is discharged, let's say, you know, they come out of it, like you said, you don't live with the condition. You either get better or you don't. Is there some aftercare at home that's required as well? I presume that there's kind of a convalescing period.
There is, for sure. And I think Rick's going to talk a little bit about some of the unmet needs for our patient population. And some of the unmet needs we have are when they go home. So I don't want to take too much of Rick's thunder, but yes, there's physical therapy, there's pulmonary rehab. You know, you'll probably need therapy due to PTSD for what you went through in the ICU. So there's many things in the recovery period post-ARDS can be quite long. There's many things people can end up with post-ARDS, pulmonary fibrosis, asthma, any type of lung issue. A lot of times post-ARDS, the patients end up with those ailments.
So what are some of the most pressing, you know, unmet needs today for ARDS patients?
So Paula, first of all, mentioned a lot of the different modalities that are available to treat while you're having the affliction, right? Just keep that in mind for a moment. Everything that Paula listed down as far as the treatments, I went through every last one of those. And every last one of them has a chance to affect your body physically in one way or another. So if you go through all of that, for example, you know, first you're ventilated, you're mechanically assisted ventilated, and then it gets to a point where they decide, as you mentioned, you have to be more comfortable. So they decide, the family has that painstaking decision of, bottom line, putting a tube in your neck. And then in my case, just like I said, then it was on to ECMO just a few days later for me. And I was on ECMO for an extended amount of time. Part of that was because of also the fact that I was waiting for a lung transplant. The only way that I was going to survive was to get that double lung transplant. So you have the treatment afterwards. So you wake up, and I'm just speaking to a severe case here. So you wake up and you discover that you've been asleep, let's say, or in some form of drug-induced hallucinatory type condition. You know, you're not, you don't have all your faculties about you. And that's problem one, because you have, you find yourself having to get reoriented with what's going on. You have to process literally in minutes everything that happened to you over the last 2 or 3 months. And it's a lot. And so they do have social workers there, part of the treatment, where they come and speak to you about it. And you progress and you start to make improvements. You learn to breathe on your own again. These are a lot of the things that are included in those treatments that Paula talked about. You literally have to learn how to breathe all over again and do it properly. There's the physical recovery of all the abuse that your body went through, going through all of this. And then there's the potential of other conditions you get diagnosed with. So you don't only have pulmonary therapy or the physical therapy, you have the emotional therapy that you're going to need for your mental health for that sake. And it's not just you, it's also your family members and your loved ones. Now they, at least where I was treated, both hospitals where I was treated, they were very gracious about making sure people had access to therapy. And it's been over 2 years since my transplant and I still go to therapy for it. There's a lot of trauma involved behind it. The hospital doesn't necessarily provide that service that whole entire time. You know, the follow-ups are, say, every couple of months in between each, you know, appointment. So what do you do in between that? I really believe the mental health side of it is suffering because there's just not enough access to it. As an example, the one hospital that I was at initially, they had exactly one psychologist for the entire ICU. This one person was trying to treat dozens of patients and their family members. How is one person supposed to do that on a daily basis like that? It's just not possible. They do have social workers there, but social workers, depending upon their background and their certifications, aren't necessarily capable of handling the one-on-one therapy. You have to have at least your master's and a certification for that. So here's this one psychologist, God love her, running around the hospital trying to make sure to attend families and help them in any way she can to try and explain these medical conditions, to try and explain what's happening to their loved one, to help them be present when making the decision on how to further their treatments and what they need. I feel fortunate my wife had that option. My wife, you know, had access to that psychologist while I wasn't able to speak for myself and while I couldn't handle things. And there was even a case where the psychologist came in and just held my hand just so I had that human contact. Family presence is a very, very important part of recovery. Knowing that somebody is there for you, knowing that somebody is willing to pick up the towel, so to speak, when you want to throw it, when you want to throw it in. That's what my wife did for me. And she was able, we were so lucky because this was, you know, after the first year of the pandemic, and she was able to still be in with me. She had to sign a waiver. She had to gown up and do all these things and had to mask, had to wear gloves. And I was contagious for roughly a three and a half week period. And so all that time she, you know, came to the hospital almost every day and just sat down and held my hand and was with me. And I knew it. I don't know how to explain it, but I knew she was there. So the allowability of family members being there for longer periods of time, in my opinion, is essential. That person knowing that they have the love and support of their family. And of course, you know, with the assistance of the psychologist, the psychiatrists, the social workers and everything that's present, mental health is lacking that care. And it needs to be for extended periods beyond what the typical is currently.
So is there any other tips that you can share with patients or clinicians with ARDS and how they can, you know, maybe help within the process?
Once again, I can only speak based on my experience and what my wife and my kids and I went through. But I think as morbid as it is, you need to have some of these conversations just in case before an emergency may happen. And that's one of the lessons that my wife and I learned. We learned that, you know, the need, for example, power of attorney, somebody capable of making the decision, somebody that will understand and somebody that's willing to advocate for you. Very first thing you need to have in place for yourself. If you don't have it, just as I'm speaking with you, if you don't have one, I'm telling you, get it set up now, because it will make things go a lot easier. And I think doctors really need to push that fact with their patients. Talk to them while they're still able to communicate. Make certain if there's anything in particular they wish to avoid as far as treatment goes. Do they want to be a do not resuscitate? Such things like that. You need to have that down somewhere on file, on record. You need to have those decisions ready to go just in case. That's a lesson I learned. But aside from that, I think it's important that the doctors remember the patient isn't necessarily always able to communicate, and it's hard and it's very frustrating. And You can't vocalize. You have to rely on somebody being able to read lips. The person that is ill, the person that is in that ICU bed doesn't have the ability to write legibly. And so the only thing that you can have to communicate, the sheet of paper with the alphabet on it and numbers maybe, and you have to try and spell out words just to get a point across. I don't know what the solution to that is, but I think there needs to be a better way somehow, something better developed for a patient to be able to communicate with the doctors. It is so hard when you are so weakened from everything that happened. You can't even press, for example, a remote button, or the nurse will come in and check on you and you're, you know, the bed is soiled, and they come in and they're like, why didn't you ring the bell for me? And the patient is just simply not strong enough to be able to do it. They are supposed to have little tap things that you can just tap your hand to it. That's not actually like pressing a button, but not every hospital has that. So there's a lot of conformity in that, I think, that needs to be done. Whereas, you know, I don't know where the funding would come from necessarily, but as an example of the ARDS Alliance, maybe that's one of the things we help with. Is there an intensive care unit that needs help developing or talking about a different way to communicate with patients while they're still able to, but they just can't verbalize it or they can't do this? There just needs to be a better way to have the patient be able to express their concerns, to have an intelligible discussion and understand what's going on with them. I sadly don't remember most of that. I guess it's sad, but it's also good in some ways. You know, there needs to be a better way for the doctors and the nurses to communicate with the patient. And surprisingly, despite technology, there really isn't. So what the answer is, I'm not certain, but hopefully someday we'll see something that is better developed to help people out like that. I think that's lacking. I also think that physical activity after completing pulmonary therapy and physical therapy is lacking also. I believe that there needs to be some sort of, whether the doctor prescribes it and holds you accountable for doing it, something along those lines. One of the key things that is so important for your lungs to try and heal and even potentially improve their function, even with fibrosis, the research is out there and shows that physical activity, you working your lungs, making them work harder, learning to take deeper breaths, you can actually improve your lung function over time. And so if there's a way that that could be, I hate to say enforced on an individual, but I feel like it kind of needs to be, because not everybody is gung-ho after this all happens. A lot of people spend multiple months depressed, sitting on the couch, not wanting to get up, just waiting for the next day to happen, and maybe something's different. So, I mean, I could go on about this for hours. It's something I'm quite passionate about, but the bottom line is, everything I just explained, you know, continued physical activity and better communication needs for the patient.
The toll it takes on the patient, and I'm sure the patient's family, you make a great point, and it's something that I think we don't always think about. Obviously, the physical recovery is challenging enough, but the psychosocial dimensions of it are also something that we need to pay attention to. The ability to communicate, as you said, is so fundamental to articulating what it is we're trying to do. Well, as you pointed earlier, too, it's not just a U.S. issue. I mean, globally, you've had interest from people that have suffered through this. Where can they go to get more information about the ARDS Alliance?
Sure. So obviously, our website, ardsalliance.org. We are on all social media channels as well. They can reach out to me as well, pblonsky@ardsalliance.org. I'm here for all the patients and families. A couple other things coming up is our biggest fundraiser of the year, going to physical activity. Rick and I will be doing a cycling event. It's called Miles for Mary Beth. Mary Beth was my sister's name that passed away. So this event's coming up on August 5th, and Rick and I will be biking 38 miles. So why 38 miles? The first World ARDS Awareness Day was 8/8/22. If you add those three numbers together, it's 38. So every year, right around World ARDS Awareness Day, which is on August 8th, we cycle 38 miles to bring awareness and much-needed funds for the ARDS Alliance. So that is coming up very quickly in 2 weeks. But yes, anyone could reach out to the website or reach out to us on social media. We are here for any of the patients or families or physicians.
Well, Rick and Paula, thank you so much. This has been a very emotional and educational conversation, and we appreciate your time to give us a kind of a insight on ARDS and the ARDS Alliance. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Exhale Podcast. Don't forget to follow us for upcoming new episodes, and please take a survey to help provide good content for the future. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again on the Exhale Podcast, brought to you by Vitalograph.